You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at the Diplomat. And I actually have some exciting news today. Prashant Parameswaran, whom you've probably read on our website and heard on this podcast before, if you're a regular listener, will be joining me weekly to host this show now. I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope you are too. Prashant, before we begin today's discussion to inaugurate your ascent to the hallowed ranks of podcast hosting, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself and what you're currently most interested in?
Sure. So as an associate editor of The Diplomat, I cover Southeast Asia and also Asia defense and security issues. And I guess that's sort of my background, a mixture of Southeast Asia expertise, but also working on issues like maritime security issues. And within Southeast Asia, I focus a lot on maritime Southeast Asia, but also Vietnam, Myanmar, and a few of the other countries as well. So.
Sounds good. And yeah, Prashant has a ton of articles on those subjects, so definitely do check out his profile on our website. Prashant, let's begin today's discussion by talking about this new development in Asian geopolitics, which is that we've witnessed the first India-Japan-US trilateral meeting at the level of foreign ministers. They've been meeting trilaterally since 2011, but we've seen essentially an elevation in that dialogue. Can you tell us a bit about what occurred and what the ministers discussed and what the significance is of this trilateral more broadly?
Yeah, okay. I think how you put it is exactly right, which is that, you know, you and I and, you know, people who've been following this very closely have been waiting for this elevation for a long time. It's been talked about over the past several years. And so it's in fact probably a long awaited crystallization of deepening cooperation between all three countries. So since we've seen not only the U.S. rebalance the Asia Pacific, but also the emergence of Modi in India and Abe in Japan, we've seen all three countries individually take a very strong role in terms of their involvement in the Asia Pacific, certainly a lot more active and a lot more assertive. And I think with this, we've also seen over the last 2 years at least a strengthening of each of the three legs of the triangle. So we've seen a growing increase in U.S.-Japan relations, U.S.-India relations, and India-Japan relations. And so we're sort of seeing all of this converge and come together in a really great way. I think some people expected this to be held a little bit earlier. I think it's about time that it's being held. With respect to the agenda of this, which is the first meeting, as you pointed out, there were a range of security and economic issues that were discussed. Some of the issues that were discussed were things that are already decided, like Japan's inclusion in the Malabar exercises that, you know, you and I have been following pretty closely. And it was originally a U.S.-India bilateral exercise, so that's pretty significant. But there are also some new initiatives that were announced. There was an expert levels group on HADR, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. There was another one on regional economic connectivity. But, you know, not a whole lot of specifics, which is, I guess, what you can expect from a first meeting. So we'll have to see whether how this progresses and evolves. But definitely at the end of the statement, all three countries expressed interest in meeting again. So we'll have to see where we take off from there.
Right. I'd also note that it was fairly significant that they mentioned the South China Sea, which obviously all three of these countries have equities in. Before I move on, I mean, I do want to talk about this trilateral a bit more because, you know, like you've correctly noted, each leg of the trilateral has been getting stronger over time. And in fact, Abe himself is one of the, you know, main victors with this trilateral being elevated during his original term as Japan's prime minister in 2006-2007, way back before, you know, Japan's current defense and national security reforms. Abe had hinted at this sort of a trilateral and even a quadrilateral arrangement, including Australia, you know, a sort of concert of democracies in Asia to essentially counter the threat of a rising China. But obviously, the entire geopolitical landscape in Asia back then was very different. China was led by a different leader. It behaved very differently. The current the threat environment in both the Western Pacific and South China Sea and the Indian Ocean was very different. So it does make sense that we've seen this crystallization and elevation occur when it has this year. And, you know, something to look forward to is, like you mentioned, the Malabar exercise. I think it'll be interesting to see if Japan actually becomes a permanent member going forward, since Japan has participated in the past, notably in 2007, actually, which I believe was right as Abe stepped out. Abe stepped down in September 2007. I believe the exercise occurred just later that year. But that was a major exercise, and it actually drew condemnation from China. So after that, they pared down the Malabar exercise considerably. So it'll be interesting to see where things go from here.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And particularly, I think the eye will be on, you know, the permanent inclusion of Japan. And then also, as you mentioned, the quadrilateral is an interesting arrangement because you have Australia coming in, and there's also been attention to the other trilateral, which is U.S., Japan, Australia as well. So that's definitely an interesting point. So I wanted to ask you, since you mentioned Japan, one of the big parts, as you mentioned, of the elevation of the trilateral has been Japan's growing influence and, I guess, its more active involvement in the Indo-Pacific, particularly with and in Southeast Asia, the Southeast Asian states. And I know you've been working on this recently. So what are some of the trends and developments we've been seeing in this regard, focusing specifically on Japan?
Sure. Yeah, I've been writing a book chapter on this, so I won't go into too much detail since this is a podcast and I don't want to be too boring. I'll talk specifically about the South China Sea, actually, because I think that's actually fairly interesting as far as Japan is concerned. I should caveat everything by saying that for Japan, when it comes to maritime and territorial disputes in Asia, it's the East China Sea that's the top priority. Obviously, that's a whole different issue that we can talk about in a separate podcast, but I just want to say that. I mean, East China Sea comes first for Japan, but then the South China Sea. Tokyo has obviously been undergoing some changes as far as its own national security and defense policies of concern. Under Abe, Japan is positioning itself to be a so-called proactive contributor to peace in the Asia-Pacific region. And obviously, as the South China Sea has risen on the Asian agenda as a possible flashpoint, Japan has become more interested. And there's also the U.S. angle to this. I mean, within the framework of the U.S.-Japan alliance, Japan's foreign policy priorities and regional engagement particularly when it comes to security, is often very much informed by what Washington is looking at. So let's go through a few of the claimant states in ASEAN in the South China Sea. The Philippines, I think, is the big one. Obviously, the Philippines continues to receive most of its overseas development aid from Japan, I believe the most. And Japan is actually the Philippines' most important trading partner in the region, which is, I believe, a unique trade in Southeast Asia. Most countries trade more with China than they do Japan, but I believe the Philippines is the one outlier there. But that is essentially the foundation. I think when it comes to the actual details, we see that Tokyo has made a bunch of moves recently that show that there is clearly some rapprochement going on between Manila and Tokyo. So Japan has supported the Philippines' arbitration case against China over the status of various maritime features in the South China Sea. We're obviously waiting to see how that will proceed after the jurisdiction issue is decided. Earlier this summer, Aquino and Abe met and strengthened their strategic partnership and elevated it. In military terms, we saw some major developments. I mean, a Japan flew a P-3C Orion flight off Palawan Island in late June, flying by Reed Bank, and that was clearly a provocation towards China. We've obviously seen, the United States fly its own surveillance flights, including a P-8 flight back in May with a news crew on board. So Japan essentially followed along and brought the Philippines on. Japan will participate in Balikatan 2015, and it participated with the United States and the Philippines in the Pacific Partnership HADR exercises off of Subic Bay. So clearly there's, I guess we could, again, going back to the issue of trilateralization, I think another trilateral we're starting to see take shape is this U.S.-Japan-Philippines trilateral. And obviously that two of those legs in that trilateral are alliances. U.S. is the common factor in both. It's an ally to both Japan and Philippines. And now Tokyo and Manila are increasing their engagement as well. Vietnam is also very interesting. We've seen, obviously, Vietnam is, in my opinion, the claimant state in the South China Sea that's most likely to get into a kinetic confrontation with China. We obviously saw last year with the oil rig standoff in summer how real some of these issues can be. So Tokyo actually started its engagement with Vietnam last year after the oil rig crisis in August 2014. Kishida, the foreign minister of Japan, visited, pledged 500 million yen to Vietnam to purchase maritime surveillance vessels. And later that year, we saw the United States announce that it would partially lift its embargo on Vietnam, which again is significant going back to the reason I talked about for how Japan's approach to the region is partly informed by what Washington is doing. So when Washington says that we're going to start selling Vietnam maritime security enabling equipment, that also tells Japan that, okay, we can start looking into this as well. So I've seen some more of that. I'm going to speed things up a bit. With Malaysia, I think it's Malaysia and Indonesia, actually. Let me talk about those two together. together, because I think both states are hedging their engagement with Japan over the South China Sea quite a bit. Both countries are also equally engaged with China. So with Indonesia, earlier this year, we saw a we saw both sides elevate their defense and security partnership and announce a bilateral defense forum, high level. Abe and Jokowi committed to free, open, and stable seas, which meshes with Jokowi's maritime fulcrum approach, which we'll talk about later on this podcast. Indonesia, I know, is on the agenda today. And Jokowi, though, you know, he hedged a bit. He visited Beijing and Tokyo on the same trip abroad, and he also made commitments to maritime cooperation with China as well. And Malaysia is also very similar. I mean, Najib Razak visited Tokyo in May, and very similarly to the Indonesian episode, you know, they announced a new strategic partnership and elevation of the bilateral relationship. In fact, some of the same language appeared. They committed to free, open, and stable seas again. But Malaysia, just like Indonesia, you know, exercised with China in August, holding its first live troop exercises, actually. And at the same time, you know, Malaysia has been also interacting closely with Karat 2015. And I know, Prashant, you've written about this, you know, how Malaysia kind of likes to play it safe on the South China Sea by keeping its relations with China close as well. But yeah, I mean, overall, you know, if you look at Japan's engagement with the South China Sea, it's abundantly clear that the South China Sea is rising on Tokyo's agenda. And it makes a lot of sense, particularly as Japan is changing its defense posture. And for Abe at home, I mean, when Abe is making the case to the Japanese public about why Japan needs to be less restrained when it comes to acting as a normal military country, showing that Japan has partnerships and friends in Southeast Asia, and it needs to help them maintain their security. That shows that, you know, Tokyo can behave as a net provider of security in the region. So I think, you know, it's all of it is kind of coming together a bit for Tokyo. And I think going forward into the next year, we'll see this continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just add two small things. I think I like what you mentioned about other emerging trilaterals. So not just between the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines, but also between U.S., Japan, and Vietnam, because there's been discussions about, you know, there definitely have been track two discussions about trilaterals and the sort. And then also, I would just emphasize, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Japan's cooperation with some of these Southeast Asian states, although it's been, you know, more active in the last few years, it's longstanding, and not just in the security realm, but also, you know, economics, people-to-people ties. And I think last year, you know, they did a survey of the perceptions in Southeast Asia of various powers, and Japan actually came up the first, even higher than the United States. So there definitely is sort of a demand for a greater Japanese presence in Southeast Asia in that regard.
Absolutely. Prashant, let's talk a bit about Indonesia, since as some of our listeners might know that Indonesian President Jokowi is coming to the United States in October. And essentially, we just want to talk a bit about Indonesian foreign policy, since it's something that doesn't really come up a lot on the podcast. But Indonesia is an immensely significant state in Southeast Asia and in Asia on the whole. So Prashant, could you just walk us through a bit about, you know, how Indonesia's foreign policy agenda and the prospects for U.S.-Indonesia relations?
Sure. Yeah, I think this is a great time to be talking about it. I mean, as you mentioned, Jokowi is going to be coming to the United States in late October. The visit was confirmed earlier this month when Indonesia's Foreign Minister Retno Marsudi was in the United States. And we're also approaching the one-year anniversary of Jokowi's inauguration coming up on October 20th. And I think, you know, with approaching one year of Indonesia's foreign policy under Jokowi, what we can say for the most part in terms of an assessment is that his foreign policy relative to his predecessor, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, has been a lot more, I think he would term it, you know, probably people-oriented and interest-focused foreign policy. It's been focused a lot on developing ties with regions other than Southeast Asia and the Asia-Pacific. They've looked at relations with some of the Gulf countries and the Gulf Cooperation Council. They're solidifying ties with some of the Pacific nations. And then I would say two other things. You know, one, the foreign policy of Jokowi seems a little less regional. There definitely does seem to be less of a focus on ASEAN, or at least a perceived lack of focus on ASEAN. And, you know, thirdly, Indonesia has been a lot more prickly about how it's been protecting its sovereignty and whether it's the South China Sea or you know, cracking down on illegal vessels that are illegally encroaching into Indonesia's waters. That definitely has been a trend that we've been seeing. And I think, you know, if I were to assess it very briefly, I would say it's almost a structural problem because, you know, Jokowi claims that his foreign policy is people-oriented and interest-focused. But the problem is some of the things that he's doing, like, you know, the sinking of vessels that are coming into Indonesia's waters or eradicating Indonesia's drug problem through tough sentencing. A lot of these measures are actually very popular at home. But they're extremely unpopular abroad, you know, whether it's
right.
regionally or globally. And I think that's sort of the structural problem that he has had to contend with. I think on U.S.-Indonesia relations, which we can probably talk about a bit later, maybe we can focus a little bit more on the global maritime fulcrum idea that he's proposed. And I think that one, you know, we've seen the sinking of some of the vessels that I've talked about, and this sort of idea about the convergence of the Indian and Pacific Oceans is a very broad agenda. And Indonesia has the chairmanship of IORA, so the Indian Ocean Rim Association, until 2017. And that sort of dovetails with this idea of Indonesia being at the center of the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And I guess in that regard, you know, I wanted to ask you what, since you follow maritime security issues pretty closely, what you make of Indonesia's global maritime fulcrum and how it's playing out, both in terms of maritime security, but also, you know, you mentioned earlier the South China Sea as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, Prashant. I mean, you know, I would go as far as to say that in my perception, and I guess the perception of many in the region, it seems like Jokowi's populism. I mean, you know, if I was following Indonesian domestic issues a lot more closely leading up to last year's election than I am now. But, you know, you heard, you know, Jokowi was this regular guy. He had this massive popular appeal. And it seems like since he's taken on the presidency, his approach to foreign policy has been very much about populism. I mean, keeping the people at home happy, protecting Indonesian sovereignty. And I think that has some, you know, worrying consequences. And I worry a bit. And, you know, I'd actually love to hear your thoughts about some of these issues later. Particularly, you know, Indonesia has always had this status within ASEAN as first among equals. I mean, it's not a formal leader in ASEAN, but, you know, I think the other ASEAN states recognize Indonesia's size, its heft, particularly when it comes to maritime security issues. I mean, Indonesia is a country composed of thousands of islands, and it's historically simply had this, you know, a central role in trade and commerce in the region. Mm-hmm. So with this maritime, with this global maritime fulcrum idea, I mean, it, you know, when I first heard it announced, it sounded like one of those grand foreign policy buzzwords that would very likely not be implemented in reality. I mean, obviously Indonesia, Jokowi was leveraging Indonesia's geographic location, which, yes, is sandwiched between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. So in that sense, yes, Indonesia is by default a fulcrum, and it can leverage that to for a great commercial benefit. But like you mentioned, you know, with these policies of sinking the vessels, it's increasing militarization, particularly, you know, we can talk a bit about Natuna Island and the South China Sea. And I should note for listeners who maybe don't watch the South China Sea super closely, Indonesia is not a formal claimant in the South China Sea. It does have equities in the outcome of security issues in the South China Sea, but it does not formally claim any territory. The Natuna Island issue is a little bit interesting since China's nine-dash-line claim technically does overlap with some waters that Indonesia claims, but it hasn't escalated to the point yet where it's a formal dispute between the two sides. I just wanted to clarify that. But yeah, I mean, let's talk a bit about, you know, Indonesia's status within ASEAN. I mean, do you think that under Jokowi, Indonesia is essentially losing interest in its traditional first among equal status within ASEAN?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is that perception among some in the region that Indonesia is losing some of its focus and interest in ASEAN. I think if you look at several of the initiatives or problems that we've talked about, so one is the ASEAN Economic Community, which is supposed to form by the end of this year. And obviously, it, you know, still remains incomplete. But I think many ASEAN states were expecting a stronger role from Indonesia in this respect. And maybe that was a little bit unrealistic, given, as you point out, I mean, it goes back to the structural problem, which is Jokowi, if you're concerned about the welfare of the Indonesian people, to be very honest and blunt, I mean, Indonesia is not ready in terms of economic competitiveness to enter the AEC, the ASEAN Economic Community, and compete with some of these other Southeast Asian countries. But the understanding was that, you know, there would be a stronger role and, you know, the Indonesian government would at least try to push for it. But unlike the previous administration, Jokowi has been very upfront about saying that, you know, he's going to be a little bit more cautious about how he approaches this. I think the sinking of the illegal vessels, you've seen Vietnam and some of the other ASEAN countries a little bit concerned about what's going on in Indonesia. And then recently with the whole haze situation, which is an annual thing in Southeast Asia, you definitely saw at least some Indonesian officials say some very assertive and I guess not very helpful things, which have alienated particularly the Singaporeans. And I think the Malaysians have said things, you know, a little bit more privately. But I think there definitely is this sense that we're dealing with, you know, potentially a more assertive Indonesia, but also an Indonesia that is looking not necessarily always to promote regional cooperation and, you know, good feeling. It's looking out for its own interests, and sometimes that can be good for ASEAN countries in the neighborhood, and sometimes that cannot be very good for them. So that's essentially what we're dealing with. I do think, I mean, it's important to emphasize there are divisions between, you know, the various interest groups in Indonesia, as there are in other countries, about, you know, how much of a change or shift there should be. Obviously, you know, there are folks in the foreign ministry who believe that, you know, ASEAN should be of greater emphasis in Indonesian foreign policy and should continue to be relative to some of the other interest groups. But that being said, you know, this is all sort of, when you talk about, you know, it's as with other countries, you know, we try to sometimes talk about U.S. foreign policy decisions as being, you know, a division between the State Department and the Department of Defense. But ultimately, countries internationally and the perceptions that are formed are based on the foreign policy outcomes, you know, not necessarily the foreign policy internal processes and some of the
right
internal workings of these governments. So I definitely think that the perception and sentiment is there. And I think the Indonesian government is very well aware of it. I'm not quite sure that they have done enough to fix it. I mean, the Indonesian foreign minister, as I mentioned earlier, Retno Marsudi, was here in the United States earlier this month. I attended the speech at the U.S. Indonesia Society that she gave. She didn't even mention ASEAN, you know, a single time in her entire remarks. And I think
in the next,
you know, talk that she delivered at the Woodrow Wilson Center, she was talking about regional architecture, and she definitely mentioned ASEAN, but most of the focus was on the Indian Ocean rather than Southeast Asia. So, I mean, I think that perception is definitely still there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to be fair, like, I have to remind myself that, you know, there is the possibility that Yudhoyono was the outlier. Indonesia has, you know, traditionally been a non-aligned state that looks out for its own interests and often behaved assertively in the past. I mean, especially, you know, in the Suharto years. So, you know, Jokowi, his foreign policy isn't something that the region hasn't seen. And there are fears that Indonesia, like you said, could go back to becoming this, you know, non-aligned state that throws its weight around looking out for its own interests. Specifically on the maritime security issue, I did want to get your thoughts on something. So in December 2014, you know, Jokowi, he shook up the Indonesian Maritime Security Agency. I believe it's called Bakamla. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Has that actually paid any dividends? I mean, I know the intent with that was to increase, you know, interdepartment coordination and protect Indonesian waters more. I mean, what have we seen in terms of results on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just because I don't want to get too much down in the weeds, but I think essentially there's two big issues when you talk about essentially what we're talking about is the fact that Indonesia doesn't really have a coast guard, and which is, I mean, to be quite honest and upfront, I mean, it is embarrassing considering that Indonesia is the world's largest archipelago state. And we talk about it. I mean, Indonesia is basically half of ASEAN economically. I mean, it's one of the leading regional and global powers. So the fact that it doesn't have a coast guard, whereas neighboring Malaysia, for example, has one of the most capable coast guards in the region, it has always been something that Indonesian policymakers have been trying to right. The problem is that this gets down in the weeds, and there's all these political struggles about funding, and which agency is going to get what, how many ships are going to be given. So that's the bureaucratic issue with respect to interagency coordination between, you know, whether you're talking about the Navy versus, you know, funding for a new Coast Guard, ships, et cetera, et cetera. I think the second part of it we need to talk about is the fact that the extent to which Jokowi wants to make advances on some of these areas, because remember, his predecessor, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, tried to do the same thing. He tried to boost and create a new Coast Guard for Indonesia, but he failed to do so, ultimately. And I think the big worry for people who are watching Indonesia now is that Indonesia's economic troubles over the last few months, which has led to, you know, growing international concerns about Indonesia as an investment destination, as one of the, you know, strongest economies, well, biggest economies at least in Southeast Asia. The concern is that the economic problems for Indonesia translate at least to problems in terms of what it's trying to do in the defense realm, right? So if you're trying to get more money for investment, you're trying to get money, more money for ships, what you need to do is, first of all, increase the amount that you have in your military budget. And unfortunately, Jokowi's been talking, he talked about it a few months ago, trying to double Indonesia's military budget, which right now is, you know, it's measly. I mean, ASEAN's average military budget is over 2%. Indonesia's had trouble even pegging it above 1%. And the goal for Jokowi is to bring it up to 1.5%. And he talked about doubling Indonesia's military budget, but, you know, over the last few months, and I've written about this, there's been talk about Indonesia potentially reducing its military budget next year. And now we're seeing some pushback from the Indonesian legislature and the Indonesian defense ministry, and hopefully the budget rises next year. But if we see cutbacks in Indonesia's defense budget, it's going to be very difficult to do things like set up a new Coast Guard and increase Indonesia's ability to police its own waters, which Indonesian officials say it's still unable to do in some sense. Yeah.
Right. That's very interesting. I didn't know. I'm not too familiar with most of the, you know, domestic background there, so that's useful. Prashant, do you want to help us wrap this up with just your impression of the state of U.S.-Indonesia relations and what we expect will come out of Jokowi's visit here next month?
Sure. I think the focus, you know, to summarize, will be, you know, U.S. and Indonesia signed a comprehensive partnership in 2013, and that sort of set out the main areas for cooperation and what they were trying to do to advance the relationship. And I think that's what they're going to try to build on when Jokowi comes here, I guess, you know, in a few weeks. And the Indonesian Foreign Minister, Retno Marsudi, in her speech that I mentioned earlier at the U.S.-Indonesia Society, which I attended, she mentioned five key areas that Indonesia wanted in terms of deepening its cooperation with the United States. These were very quickly, you know, trade and investment, the maritime realm, security and defense, education and democracy, and pluralism. And I would just point out, you know, two or three key things. I mean, I thought when I listened to the speech, the most interesting thing that I found out of that was, and the most promising, was in security and defense, the mention of development and joint production of defense technology and technology transfer. That's a key area for development. And if U.S. and Indonesia can cooperate in that area more so, that would be a significant boost for the relationship. I think another one that you mentioned was, you know, advancement of trade and investment in the areas of the creative economy and information technology. That's something that could be promising as well. I think the third one that you and I would be very interested in is to see what happens in terms of the maritime agenda. You know, the U.S. is already assisting Indonesia in terms of boosting its maritime domain awareness. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see what else is on the table in terms of concrete things when it comes to helping Indonesia boost its maritime security, particularly since, as I was telling you, you know, there are a lot of worrying trends about, you know, whether Indonesia will be able to sufficiently fund its ability to strengthen its own maritime security and maritime domain awareness. So the extent to which partners like the United States can help it do so will be a significant thing to watch.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Prashant. And like I said, I'm looking forward to you being on this show regularly from now on.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Thanks a lot for listening, everyone. And if you like this podcast, leave us a review on iTunes and leave us a rating as well. And we'll be back next week with more.